Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order February 4th, 2019. It's a Monday. I'd like to just remind everybody to put the mute button on their cell phones so they don't interrupt the meeting. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Olson, Senator Machicki, Senator Schauer, Senator Wilikowski. We have a couple items today on the agenda. We're going to talk about the state debt overview and credit rating and how that's where it's been, where it's at, and maybe a little bit about where we might end up going forward with it. Then we're going to talk about the savings accounts and budget reserves, which is basically the liquidity issue. And we'll be spending some time on that over the next couple months, and that'll be driving a lot of the decisions. Obviously, it's the ability to meet our obligations to run the state and make our payroll and treat future Alaskans fairly with our decisions. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and ask Mr. Devin Mitchell to come forward. He is the state debt officer, and if he could introduce himself for the record, who he represents, and possibly Mr. Mitchell, when you, before you start, maybe for the people at home, give just a brief synopsis of how long you've, been in that position and a little bit, maybe smidgen on your background. Everybody at the table is familiar with you, but there'll be people at home that will not be. And then proceed with your presentation, please.
Sure, thank you. For the record, Devin Mitchell, I'm the state's debt manager. I also work as the executive director of the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank, one of the state's public corporations, and serve as staff to a couple of other public corporations that have been created but haven't issued obligations historically. I was born in Cordova, Alaska, back in 1968, so that's where it started. But I've worked here in the Department of Revenue since 1992, and as the state's debt manager in acting capacity starting in 1998, and then that was formalized subsequent to that, and I think it was 1999 or early 2000. So I've been in this role for some time and seen good times and bad throughout the course of that history. And today, this presentation, it's organized into three basic components. I mixed it up a little bit from the format from last year. So debt capacity is first, and then talk a little bit about state credit rating, and then talk about outstanding obligations of the state, the various layers of outstanding obligations. And so we have a requirement in state statute that was created in 2008 to annually provide an estimation of the state's debt capacity in a manner that aligns with rating agency analytical criteria. The state of Alaska, with its small population and relatively, in comparison to our population, the wealth of the state or the financial resources of the state dwarf the comparison to many, if not all, of the other 49 states. And so rather than relying on some of the metrics like debt per capita or debt to personal income, we landed on this debt to or debt as a percent or annual debt service as a percent of unrestricted general fund revenue. And so for the direct obligations of the state, that is general obligation bonds and obligations that the state is the only payer on, like a certificate of participation or a lease revenue bond, the percentage that's acceptable is 5% of unrestricted general fund revenue can be used for those types of obligations. And then when you combine that with the school debt reimbursement program and certain other obligations of the state, up to 8%. And the reason that I put this first is because this year we've had some significant changes in unrestricted general fund revenue with the passage of Senate Bill 26. As a result of that that change in unrestricted general fund revenue and the somewhat uncertain nature of the tenure of the FY19 format, meaning that it's uncertain if that'll remain unrestricted general fund revenue into the future or not. There was a 1% reduction made to the ratios that we just discussed. So instead of 5 and 8%, we're using 4 and 7% for purposes of determining debt capacity.
Before you go to the next slide, maybe for those at home, why is Senate Bill 26 of any significance, and what is that?
So Senate Bill, through the chair, or the Senate Bill 26 was the bill that created the percent of market value transfer from the earnings reserve of the permanent fund, and that for FY19 resulted in a significant increase in unrestricted general fund revenue, as while the earnings of the permanent fund, the annual earnings, as well as the earnings reserve have been available for any use by a majority appropriation of the legislature with concurrence of the governor, it hadn't been used for general governmental purposes in the past other than the Amaretta Hess portion of the fund.
Yeah, thank you. And just let the record reflect that Senator Giesel, Senate President, was here, has joined us and has been here since the beginning of the meeting, and I forgot to mention that when we started, but go ahead and continue.
On the next page, this is last year's debt affordability analysis, and you can see we have the fall 2017 unrestricted general fund revenue from the revenue sources book, and that ranges from $2 billion to $2.8 billion. And the percentage of UGF committed to state debt, you can see in 18, it exceeded our metric 5%. It was 5.4% and didn't drop below until 2020. And so and on the 8% metric, which is the next column over, we are again over at 10.8%, and we didn't drop under the metric target of 8% until 2022. And so the capacity that we projected last year of $300 to $400 million was really based on the out years, that 2023 to 2027 time frame, and the ability that you would have to sculpt debt service into a schedule that would result in your hitting 5% or 8% in those different target metrics for those years. And so that's where that ability to borrow would have come from. We started incorporating the payments on behalf of PERS and TERS into this sheet a couple of years ago. It's been more informational than a hardwired percentage target for the debt capacity analysis, but it highlights the significance of the commitment that the state has with the unfunded liabilities of the PERS and TERS trusts and the payments that are required to pay back that unfunded liability over time as constructed in Senate Bill 125 in 2008.
Could you highlight, please, for us the two far right columns and the difference?
The percentage of unrestricted general fund, which is the next to last column that's committed to the projected special payment on behalf of PERS and TERS. In the bill that I just referenced, the state determined that it was in the best interest of the system to limit employers' contributions for PERS to 22% of payroll. So there's, I can't recall how many participants in PERS, but 100, let's say, and those employers all paid 22% of payroll. The actuary goes through an analysis of the funding levels and the expectations of payouts for participants that results in an actuarially calculated rate or a percentage of payroll that should be paid to make up that balance over a finite time frame. And that, whatever that winds up being, if it's 26%, well, the state has to provide a payment on behalf of the employers that's equal to all the employers' 4% of their payroll. And the same thing applies to TERS, except for the limiter for the TERS employers is 12.56%. And so the state, again, makes a supplementary payment, or it's called a special funding situation in some circles, that makes up that difference. And so the state, once it's committed to doing that and making those payments and has made them, it actually transfers that liability onto the state's balance sheet. under the GASB rules or generally accepted
accounting
standards.
Principles.
What's that?
Accounting principles.
There you go. Generally, I'm not an accountant. And so at this point, since it's on our balance sheet and it's something that the state's committed to pay and has been paying, we've included it informationally. And then the final column is just that payment commitment added to the more inclusive total state-supported debt column.
Okay.
And so this is 2018, and this is 2019, and what the outstanding obligations really didn't change. There hasn't been any new state debt issued. The school debt reimbursement program's in a moratorium. There's no new school debt reimbursement program, but you can see the ratios drop significantly, and it's really just, and you can also see the unrestricted general fund revenue increase significantly over $3 billion. That's in part due to an increase in the forecasted price of oil, but more significantly because of the projected transfers from the earnings reserve to the general fund through as part of the mechanics of Senate Bill 26.
And then can you define how you handled the dividend calculation within that 5.25% draw?
Through the chair, I don't. That's the I just look at what unrestricted general fund revenue is. I don't look at expenses.
Here we have a question from Senator Machikian and Senator Von Imhoff.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mitchell. When you talked about the reduction of 1% to debt ratio limits due to the increase in revenue available, and I see the 1% there on the cap from 5 to 4 and 8 to 7. Who makes that determination?
Through the chair, Senator Machikian, that's a determination made within the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue is the agency charged with compiling the debt affordability analysis, and in large part it was a recommendation of myself based on the short, like I said, short tenure of the shift in use of earnings of the permanent fund in conjunction with the just significant change in projected capacity that it results in. So that 1% differential, it's about $800 million in capacity, and it would be disingenuous, I think, to be telling people that we have a capacity of $3 billion when we don't know if this is going to be the case next year.
Mr. Chairman.
Good follow-up?
Yeah, just brief. I support the conservative philosophy. I'm just curious what body made that determination. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff and Senator Walikowski.
Thank you. So I want to say thank you very much for showing the 2018 to 2019 and how the POMV, which we call it here a structured draw on the permanent fund. So thank you for showing that. And I really also appreciate the two right-hand columns to show PERS and TERS. And while officially it's not considered debt under the definition of a geo bond or municipal bond or something of that source, it is a real debt to the state and does need to be incorporated and considered over the long term. So as you can see from one year to the next, it does go up. And when we had our PERS and TERS presentation last week, they're indicating that the cost to the state or the payments required for the state in the future is certainly going up, but in the magnitude of hundreds of millions of dollars one year to the next. And so I think I appreciate you including this. I think it's very real, and it's something that this committee needs to keep in mind as it goes forward and contemplates all the different moving parts that will be presented to us. Thank you.
Senator Walikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to get back to Senator Stedman's question about the projected PFD. How much are you projecting? What is the split between PFDs and fund transfers to government?
And then when you answer that question, could you add into your answer, considering your answer, the distortion that may be implicit in the numerics if the dividend isn't taken account in any regard in? And how do you account for the statutory obligation we have to pay a dividend under the current formula? And Because it appears that in this chart that we have no obligation, and it would distort the numerics considerably, I would think.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, and again, I don't make assumptions or projections about how expenditures are going to be determined. It's really a matter of what are the resources that are available to the state. And this is the resource that's reported as being available to the state in the Revenue Sources Book, which is the official publication for projecting revenues. The decisions that you have to make are obviously more difficult than that, and they're more nuanced than that. But if I were going to project the state's credit quality and ability to pay its obligations, this is the number I would use. And when choices are made about how that number is used, those are just that, choices.
Okay, so I'd like to have you go ahead and restate this for informational purposes, and I'd like you to follow the statutes that are on the books, which would dictate that we pay a dividend. If we don't pay a dividend, the full statutory dividend, that's, I guess, a political decision. But clearly, as we sit here today, there is a statute on the books that requires a dividend roughly at $3,000, a little less than that, per individual in this upcoming year, and it would, I would think, change these numerics. So if you could give us that slide, and we'll consider both sets of information as we go forward.
Through the chair, maybe it would be something, I mean, certainly we can do that. Would it make sense to have it as a percentage, kind of to follow the format, so you could just add a column that's the 1982 statutory permanent fund dividend and what percentage of UGF that represents by year? I mean, we could have dollar amounts too for all of these columns if you'd like.
Correct. I think if you take the column on the left-hand side, starting with $5.495 billion, it would shave off a billion plus, which would change all your percentages going across the screen. Because if we follow the statutes, we may have unrestricted general fund revenue, but the percentages, I think, it would show a different debt load that we're actually facing when we deal with the dividend.
Through the chair, certainly it definitely would. It would look more similar to the prior year. There would be an improvement, but it wouldn't be as drastic as this suggests.
Right, and it'll be just another piece of information that we have at the table when we struggle with how we're going to deal with our deficit obligations and the statutory obligations to pay a dividend.
Certainly. So, again, on this slide, we already ran through what the different columns mean, and so you can see that there's significant headroom as currently presented without a assumption about spending for anything, one program or another, including dividends, and we'll adjust that. But this adjustment in unrestricted general fund revenue, as I said earlier, and as I said last year when people were considering Senate Bill 26 and asked, it increases the state's debt capacity to around $2 billion. And that's really just, again, a function of the ability to have annual expenditures in each one of those years, 2019 through 2028, that would support a debt load.
But doesn't that include paying no dividend to max out your debt obligations or debt capacity?
Through the chair, no, it doesn't. I mean, you can have debt service without. I mean, it's really a matter of what are you going to spend money on, and that's the pot of money that you have, and then you're going to, if you say, well, of that pot of money, a certain amount of it is an acceptable amount to have for ongoing recurring obligations that are related to debt, and then whatever is left, you spend on whatever you want, and that can include a full dividend program, it can include anything else that's determined to be worthy of funding.
I think some of us might disagree on the position of the obligation of the dividend to the people in the format of how we're going to split the revenue to take care of the dividends, expenditures, and debts. And the reason to keep bringing this subject back on the table is Alberta, my understanding, is now facing roughly $50 billion in debt that they've issued to deal with the declining oil prices because they didn't want to deal with the budget impacts of or the budget reductions. And that is exactly the road we do not want to go down, the Alberta road, where we have $50 billion in debt and we haven't dealt with their operating budget problems. Senator Onimov.
Thank you. I usually think of it this way. When looking at debt capacity, I know they're going to be talking about it a little bit more in a few future slides. You look at how much money do you have, how much cash flow do you have to cover your debt? And the question is now you have on this slide almost $5.5 billion. Do we really have that cash flow, or do we not have that cash flow? Because if we don't have that cash flow because there's a statute in place that takes $1.9 billion out of that, then it means that we have less cash to actually cover the outstanding debt we have now, let alone incur any new debt. And I think that's the key when you have regulators or analysts that look at municipalities, states, and so forth. They're gauging on what kind of decisions are the leaders engaging in when they decide to incur more debt. Is there additional cash flow to pay it out? Do they have the capacity or do they not? And I think I'm assuming that's what Senator Stedman is alluding to. Yes, a column showing 5.5 minus 1.9 billion is absolutely prudent because it's on the books and it's something that we're discussing now, and we would love to see that.
Senator Schauer and Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to point out that when we had our briefing from the Department of Revenue Commissioner-elect, that number, which would be $3.2 billion, is the number he's using as far as the revenue forecast when we're discussing it. So just wanted to make that point that that seems to be the path we're going down for the budget that's about to be released. That is the number.
Senator Michiki.
So there are two things. One is, and that's the number I came up with, 3.248 approximately. I think the column needs to go to the right just so Alaskans can understand the difference to the right of the unrestricted general fund revenue forecast. I mean, I would like to see what is there without a dividend to the right when a full statutory dividend is paid out to the right of that, and then the calculations afterward, and just so that everyone understands that impact. I think if we do a separate slide where it's not obvious, they may not understand. But follow up?
Yes.
Is there a generally accepted percentage of UGF committed to debt across the U.S. that we can compare to so that we know what kind of position we're in compared to other states?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki. Certainly, in the debt affordability analysis, there's some comparisons to some other states, and we're in the realm of metrics that other highly rated states use. Just as a matter of obligation, the discussion that's going on at the table is actually great from my perspective, because what my job isn't to make. I'm not going to decide what the permanent fund dividend should be, if it should be bigger or smaller. The last 3 years, it's been smaller than the statutory formula, and what that highlights from my perspective at this point is that it's available for other purposes, and that it's important that people recognize that there's choices to be made with that pot of money, and that one of the very important ones to everybody in this room is and around the state is what's that permanent fund dividend amount going to be.
I can assure you it will not be zero. It's some number north of that, and probably south of $3,000. I think that slightly south of that is, I think, the technical target, $2,900 some odd. It's not going to be zero. So if you can help us with the resetting of this information to the committee, that would be appreciated. Was there another question after Michiki? I think we got them all. Okay, next slide.
So I think we've covered most of the language that's on this slide. Maybe the only point that's on here that you haven't heard would be that a $100 million recurring revenue increase results in a long-term debt capacity increase of 60 to 70 million, just how the relatively conservative math that we use for determining what capacity might be works out.
Senator Von Imhoff?
I assume the converse is true as well then.
That is correct, through the chair. And again, I would highlight that it hasn't been debt load that has changed. It's when you look back and through time and say, well, geez, how could we have ever gotten above our metrics? We were well below our metrics when that debt was issued, and it's been the volatile revenue experience that we've had since 2014 that's resulted in our, as a state, exceeding the metrics that were established.
Somebody flash your hand, Senator Michiki, or Shower, was it Michiki?
It was.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So realizing that if we include the statutory requirement for the dividend, that it's going to be somewhere between that 2.063 and 5.198, somewhere around 3.2 billion. That may change your decision on the self-imposed cap as well. Can you talk about that relationship? If we're asking for you to clarify the statutory dividend in here, does that affect your decision on dropping the cap by 1%?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, that's again a good observation that it would, because a lot of the uncertainty that I saw in these numbers related to that number, the permanent fund dividend number. And so if it's removed, then I think you fall back to the metrics that we used historically.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
So that concludes debt capacity, and we'll move to state debt rating overview. And so we have ratings from the three major rating agencies, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch. 2010 to 2014, we had AAA credit ratings, the highest credit ratings available. Things were obviously going well for the state in that time frame. I think for the 3 years leading up to FY15, we have had an average price of oil in the $105 range. Fairly stable revenue times and high revenue times. That changed in the fall of 2014 when the price of oil started going down and went down more than folks expected to the $20 levels. And so that resulted over that time frame. And while the state struggled with how to deal with those revenue reductions in 7 credit rating downgrades and at least that many more rating agency write-ups that are cautionary in nature. They have negative outlooks they can put on ratings. They have credit watch they can put on ratings. And we had both of those during that time frame. And more recently in 2018 and 19, we had rating stabilization with moving to stable on all three of our ratings. Moody's has us one notch below the other two at this point at the lowest of the AA ratings, AA3. While S&P and Fitch have us at the mid-AA level. On the next slide, we have some of the challenges that I was running up against in my job. And so my role, again, isn't to determine how money's going to be spent or policy decisions. It's trying to portray the state of Alaska in the strongest manner possible. And so I try to highlight the credit story that demonstrates strength and flexibility rather than trying to move an agenda forward. And so the feedback I was getting from the investor community or the three points on the left that Alaska's economy is totally reliant on oil and is in free fall, reserves are dwindling, and the state won't be able to balance its budget. And there's definitely been impacts in the state over the course of the last 4 years, but if you look at just GDP as of 2016, the only sector that had a decline was the oil and gas or mining sector. And so the other sectors, and this was kind of surprising to me, were either stable or growing. And oil as a percentage, or mining as a percentage, of the GDP of the state had diminished significantly as well and only represented about 13%. I think some of the other points that I would make when discussing the strength that the state has is that that the difficulty is that we have too many choices. We have too many alternatives, and we're the only state in the nation that gives money away to its residents and doesn't have a broad-based income tax or sales tax. And that's, while maybe difficult to deal with change, an incredible strength that others would love to have. And so it's a discussion point that we've had several times when talking about Alaska's credit situations. And as far as the reserves dwindling, the net position of the state actually increased from 2016 to 2017. Reserves have evolved, and there are arguments about how they're available and what they're available for. But there's reserves, there's the CBRF, SBR, and the earnings reserve. And the earnings reserve, again, is the one, the account that Senate Bill 26 modified the potential uses of. But just strictly from a financial analytical perspective, again, it's available with a simple majority appropriation of the legislature and concurrence of the governor. That doesn't mean that's going to happen, but it means it's available. And then the state won't be able to balance its budget. And I, again, there was with changes made last year, a budget that could be balanced in FY19. And again, I don't know that practice is going to continue into the future, but at least for that fiscal year, this fiscal year, there was actually a use of resources that came close to resulting in a balanced budget. And oftentimes when we talk about a balanced budget, if you look at money in and money out to the organization, we had more money in than we had money out, and yet we'll say we had a fiscal deficit because the money in is in categories that we save for certain things. If money goes into the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, it doesn't count as current year revenue. It counts as restricted current year revenue, even though it's available for appropriation. There's a higher hurdle to use that money, but it's still available. So we don't portray ourselves as an organization as strongly as we could for purposes of external investors.
So when we compare us to other states, and we look at their base source of revenue, income tax and sales tax. How many other states own their subsurface and create the wealth that to the state that Alaska has versus the individual in the other 49 states?
Through the chair, I don't know the answer to that.
Zero. You know the answer to that. We're the only state in the union that has these vast resources owned by the common. You know that as well as I do. Alberta is similar to Alaska. So it's difficult to compare Alaska to the other states when we look at their sources of revenue. And then it makes it also difficult for the state when we look at the diversification of our industries because of the colossal value of our oil. A few years ago, at its peak, it was $20 billion a year in gross revenue, to 21 or 2 maybe, and now it's around $11 billion. in gross revenue. So we are in a very unique position if the rating agencies want to recognize it or not. We are the only state like this that exists and intentionally structured like this. Senator Von Imhoff.
My question is actually in a couple slides. Thank you.
Okay. We'll have Senator Bishop and then Senator Machicki, and then we'll, when we're done with the questions, we'll go to the next slide.
Mine's not really a question so much as a comment, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mitchell, you said we give away money for a dividend, and I don't totally, I mean, I think we're all shareholders. Getting back to Senator Stedman's comments, we're all shareholders in a corporation because the state owns everything from 6 inches below the ground to the center of the earth. So we're all shareholders in that respect. And we have a formula for a dividend for the shareholders. And I just like that. I don't know if I'm accurate or not, but I don't know if you maybe misspoke. And I just want to see if you agree with that comment.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop. That sounds as good of an explanation as any for how we've organized ourselves.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mitchell, I would really love to see if the chair agrees. On the reserves are dwindling slide, you make two comments. The reserves increased and the net position of Alaska has increased as a result of the FY17 activity. I would love to see a net position slide with Anchorage CPI applied to it. When burning through over $13 billion in CBR funds, I'd like to see a net position slide that includes the permanent fund, the SBR, the CBR, compared to Anchorage CPI, to see if that's actually a true statement.
We have that in the coming today. I don't recall that we have it, an inflation adjuster or the CPI adjusted, but it's coming. Mm-hmm.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, yeah, no, that wasn't inflation adjusted, what my statement. So certainly that could change the outcome. And so here's a couple of slides that we would use to, one of the things that you hear a lot is Alaska has the highest unemployment rate in the country, which is true, but our unemployment rate is relatively stable. The rest of the country has, we had 8% unemployment rate a few years ago, and we were one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country. And now we're, you know, down below that, and we have the highest. So it's, again, it's not us that changed. It was the rest of the country has done either really well or really poorly. Housing values, we've been fortunate that housing values have been stable in the state of Alaska. We haven't had the types of experiences that you saw in the lower 48 with housing value fluctuations. We've had stability in job growth. While we've had reductions over the last several years, we still have more years of job growth than the U.S. average. And then the last chart, again, when you think about Alaska, while oil and gas only represent 4% of employment in the state, there's a lot of obviously employment that's driven by revenues derived from oil and gas activity. But just looking at the pie chart, it's a lot more diverse than a uninformed investor would give the state credit for. And then this slide, Mr. Chair, there might be a question.
Oh, Senator Schauer. Sorry, I didn't see you. I was looking down at the pretty pie graph coming.
You're very busy. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just on the government, just a curious number of that breakdown. Does that include state and federal, or is that state only?
It does include, it should include, and I can't recall, we got this slide from the Department of Labor, and so I would need to refer back to that. But my assumption would be that it should include state, local, and federal government. But there could be some governmental spending, like some local governmental spending could be for hospitals, for example. Juneau or Ketchikan own their own hospitals, and so that could then fall into the healthcare sector as an example of it being government in some ways, but then another sector in others.
Can you go ahead and continue?
And this slide is, so another one of the credit stories that we've been talking about, and it's similar to some of the comments the chair and others have made, is that Alaska isn't like other states. No other state has a permanent fund or a reserve like the permanent fund. And the permanent fund, by its very makeup, is a diversifier. The permanent fund isn't invested in, while it might be in some part in the future, it isn't invested in, directly in the in Alaska projects. And so you have over 3,000 firms that are held by the permanent fund that creates more economic diversity from a revenue generation perspective than a state that's reliant on a broad-based tax, like a California, for example, that might have an income tax that when certain sectors decline, then California suffers significantly, and there's an earnings range held by the diverse asset allocation that the permanent fund has that makes it's a revenue generator that contributes to our economy, whether the money is distributed in a dividend or spent on some other governmental service one way or the other, and it's derived not from our economy but from a worldwide economy. And this is probably the slide that makes the most sense right now. And it's the CBR-SBR balance and the decline that it's had. And this is what investors were hearing about when they were talking about the state has dwindling reserves and dwindling at a pace that in a form that it appears they don't have any alternative once this reserve is depleted. And you can see this is just the historical balance of the CBR-SBR from 2013 through 2018 and the various sum of the rating actions and reports that were released during that time, downgrading the state's credit.
Are you done with the slide?
I don't know. Was there a question, Mr. Chairman?
Well, we're going to wait till you're done with the slide.
I am done with the slide.
Okay. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Mitchell, having been in this position for almost two decades and kind of looking back at slide 7 and then this particular slide and then bringing in the previous discussions that we've just been having in regards to what really is our undesignated general fund revenue available to pay debt, we've seen this slide shows a free fall of debt rating in the last several years, and at the very small blip in the far right, it says outlook to stable, which is great news. In your professional opinion, what might Moody's and Fitch and S&P think if the state chooses to give out 2/3 of its structured draw in the form of a statutory dividend, thereby leaving about 1/3 available to pay for operations as well as increasing debt, and then choose to go out and incur more debt in its remaining OBIT capacity in order to pay for capital projects, whether it be bridges or schools or roads or what have you, and incurs debt voluntarily and chooses not to use money that we normally would have to invest in capital projects and things of that nature, what might Moody's think about that?
Through the chair, Senator Von Arnhoff, the scenario that you just described would most likely result in some form of report that would be negative in nature, meaning that there would be concern about. Certainly, if the state were going down that path and trying to issue additional debt, that would be a viewed as a negative credit decision. It has to be a little bit more holistic, meaning that if there's a balanced budget, that and you're doing those things, then you might have a greater ability to withstand negative rating action. If you don't, it's really about how is the state going to pay its expenses in perpetuity? And if you don't have a plan that provides for that and you're in a situation where you currently aren't providing that for that out of current revenue, that results in concerns.
Follow-up.
Thank you. Well, I do appreciate the example. If it's a holistic, and if there's a balanced budget, then that depends. But, you know, a balanced operating budget, of course, as you know, is different than leaving additional funds available for the PERS and TERS, for debt, for capital. So balanced is, we have to make sure that we understand really what the definition is. But the question that I have is, you mentioned it could result in a negative response. What then, walking that out, what does that mean to the state of Alaska if there is a negative response, as in the rating gets downgraded? What does that mean to us?
Through the chair, it would mean that when we did borrow money, we would pay more to borrow money because the rating is an evaluation of the state's creditworthiness, similar to a credit score an individual might have. So if you have a 200 credit score as an individual and you never borrow money, well, it doesn't really impact you, other than if your friends know you have that low of credit score, maybe they look down on you. I don't know. If you're a state that has a AAA rating and you never borrow money, well, maybe your friends go, wow, what a great state. They've got a AAA rating, but it doesn't really do you that any good from a financial perspective, unless you're actually going to be borrowing money in some capacity. So as the state's credit rating deteriorates, there's, I think, more pressure on certainly the other program I work with, the bond bank, relies on the state's rating to borrow money from municipalities, and so the cost of certain municipal borrowing is going to go up in tandem with the state's cost of borrowing going up, but otherwise.
It affects the secondary market. You want to briefly touch on that?
Through the chair, so holders of our debt right now, if you have a bond that's rated AA and it is downgraded to AA3, it might not be worth a dollar anymore. It might be now worth 97 cents because with the perceived risk, the next purchaser of that is going to want a higher yield, a rate of return on their money because of that perceived risk, and so they're going to be willing to pay you less for your security.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, I guess we'll go to the next slide.
So this would be then the slide that shows the growth of the permanent fund earnings reserve during that same time frame. And so you can see that while the CBR and SBR have been drawn down, the permanent fund coincidentally in that same time frame grew to a more robust balance. And comparing 2013 to 2019, just on a nominal basis, you can see that it's a higher balance. Whether or not, again, those revenues are going to be available for anything but a permanent fund dividend remains to be seen.
So should we expect this growth in the earnings reserve to continue, or is this somehow related to returns in the capital markets? And what would happen if we had a 08, 9, and 10 years in the capital budget? Would this slide look the same?
Through the chair, there's since the earnings reserve is a statutory formula rather than a mark-to-market type formula, there's I'm not sure how negative years would impact it, since if you look back historically at the permanent funds earnings, I think they've been negative twice, which, as you know, the market has had more negative years than two during that time frame. So there is, because it's a statutory formula that's used for determining what earnings are and what's transferred into the earnings reserve, it's realized gains or realized income. So dividends and coupon rates on fixed rate securities, and then if you buy or sell something, the loss or gain that you would have had on that is what's used for determining permanent fund statutory income, which But certainly if we had a number of bad years, you would expect this number to go down. I mean, the balance available in the earnings reserve to go down.
I think it's gone down just the last couple months. It's very sensitive to market returns. And in fact, we've been fortunate that we've had a big bull market at the same time we've depleted our savings. So if we have a protracted bear market or a flat market, this growth curve wouldn't look anything like this. Most likely it would be heading south. And if there's any questions about that, we can bring in the permanent fund and go into more detail. But that's in fact mechanically how it works.
I would agree with you.
Okay. Next slide, please.
So here's what it looks like if you combine the three accounts. And again, you can see that's just how it worked out, that fund balance has gone up and it's gone down, it's gone back up. And as you pointed out, it's gone down, although January maybe is a better month.
Yep. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what Senator Stedman was trying to say is you start this graph in 2013. Do you think it might be prudent to start this graph in something like maybe 2005 or 6, only because you'll, and even let's just say 2000 if we're in the discussion point, because then we will see two bear markets during that time in the early 2000s and again in 8, 9, and 10. And I think that's more indicative. The rate that you've, or the time frame that you've shown is one of the better bull markets. And I think it's over time, as you know, you can kind of just see the volatility of the permanent fund. And so it's just something to think about. And it also shows how the CVR really was at a low balance for quite some time, mm-hmm. until the peak of essentially the 2013. And that sort of shows its own volatility as well. So if you have the capacity to do that, I think seeing a chart of a longer time frame could be more comparable.
So if you could come back to the committee with that, we'll just start the year 2000. Sounds like a good number. If you think it's, you want to run another year, set of year scenarios, you can include that too. Mm-hmm. But I think that would be informative to have the a little broader historical view, because it is a concern of the table as we've taken down the CBR to a couple billion dollars. If we have the wind against our sails in the capital markets for some time, we could really start getting into a cash flow squeeze.
Through the chair, yeah, I know it will be interesting to look at. I know certainly the CBR was, in 2000, what was it, $1.2 billion. And so you saw significant growth in the CBR in part while you were chair of this committee with repayments of the CBR obligations, and the permanent fund earnings reserve was relatively low. And in fact, it's been modified, but there was a perception at one point, a legal, and I'm not an expert on legal matters or otherwise, but just generally that if there were a loss within the permanent fund, it was all it all accrued to the earnings reserve at one point in time, and so there was an incredible potential for volatility in the earnings reserve with that interpretation. That's since been modified, is my understanding, and so now it's more of a pro rata situation, so that if there's a loss of market value or in the portfolio, it doesn't all accrue to the earnings reserve. It accrues to both principal and the earnings reserve on a pro rata basis. So, but it will be interesting to see that chart, certainly.
Okay. That would be good. And then, again, you have the freedom if you want to do a couple other runs, too, and start some different years. Whatever you think would be most informative to the committee.
Sure.
Senator Michicki.
Now, this slide kind of demonstrates my doubt that the net position has been positive over time. And you look at May of 14, the net position just of the SBR and CBR and the earnings reserve was about $23 billion. And the total today, according to this chart, January of 19 is about $18 billion, and that's absent CBR. So that's where my doubt came from. I don't think we're net positive on reserves.
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, and I don't misunderstand me. I wasn't suggesting that our net position increased every year since 2014. I said, I meant 2016 to 2017, which there was a diminishment of net position in prior years, and a lot of that was really a diminished balance in the general fund as a lot of capital project money was spent that had been appropriated but not yet gone out the door. And so fund balance went down because those appropriations weren't being replenished by current year revenue after 2014.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm just, for the public listening, they may have gotten the false impression mm-hmm. that our net position had not been dramatically decimated. I think it's important that they understand what happened over the last 4 years as opposed to the last year and a half.
And why we're backed into the permanent fund as we sit here today. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Mitchell, I think it's important just to kind of acknowledge on the record that a contributing factor in the last 3 years and why we have an improved or a cash position that we do have is because we paid lower dividends out of the permanent fund. We took less money, drew less money from the ERA, therefore left more money to earn in this bull market. We were fortunate that it was a bull market, but regardless, just taking money less to pay dividends has increased that uptick there in 2017-18, or contributed to it.
Through the chair, I agree, yeah.
Go ahead and continue.
And so then this slide shows those things combined with the price of Alaska North Slope crude added as a orange line just to make things kind of interesting on this chart. And then the different points that we borrowed money from 2013 to 2016 and the types of interest rates that we were able to achieve on those borrowings. And so I think, luckily, while the price of oil has diminished since early October, when I think it touched $85 or $80 a barrel for a day, the current price has rebounded above $60 a barrel. But still, our revenue is directly tied to that, and as goes the price of oil, so has gone our short-term, if you want to call it that, or the CBR and SBR balances. And so then this next section is state debt and general fund obligations. So in order for us to have a state debt or an obligation, it must first be authorized by law, and it can be in a not-to-exceed issuance amount, or so it would be a form of revolving authorization to borrow, or it can be a one-time issuance. For general obligation bonds, which are really the one true debt of the state, and I'm sure the majority of the folks around the table, we've had conversations about different levels of credit pledges that the state can provide. And general obligation bonds are authorized by the Constitution and include with them a full faith credit pledge and taxing authority commitment of the issuer to pay them back. And that in part is why they must also be approved by a majority of the voters prior to being authorized. So state debt is authorized and issued by the State Bond Committee, which is comprised of the Commissioners of Admin, Revenue, and Commerce. And so GO bonds, subject to appropriation commitments, as well as state revenue bonds, which are fairly limited, the sport fish revenue bonds and the Alaska International Airport System revenue bonds. And if the Clean Water Drinking Water Fund issued revenue bonds would also flow through the State Bond Committee. We have some other obligations with the school debt reimbursement program, and then there's this other reimbursement program, House Bill 528, that was passed back when Lida Green was in the legislature, so it was early 2000s. And those are reimbursement programs where the underlying municipality is required to issue generally, certainly for the school debt reimbursement program and for a majority of these House Bill 528 reimbursements, general obligation debts of the municipality and then the state agrees to provide a reimbursement up to 100% of the debt service on those obligations. The state hasn't always appropriated the full amount for the school debt reimbursement program. There was some short fundings in the late 80s, early 90s, and then more recently there was a short funding. But generally those commitments have been provided for by the state through the annual appropriation process. And then the retirement systems, we've talked about that a little bit. It's been determined that the defined benefit employees' benefits are guaranteed by the Constitution. There was a court case wherein which that was determined, and that we've now added the unfunded actuarially assumed liability to the state's financial report, comprehensive annual financial report. The one thing about the unfunded liability is that you do have some flexibility, and that's been used historically to both extend term, as well as, I mean, the restructuring where the state agreed to pay rates above 22% for PERS or 12.56 for TERS. And so there are, and the $3 billion one-time payment in 2015, and so there are opportunities to flexibly deal with the calculated liability, but it is non-dischargeable as currently understood. So this is just a rundown of a table that comes out of the Alaska Public Debt Book, another annual publication of the Department of Revenue that goes through each category of obligation that the state has, and it starts with the highest level of category with general obligation debt, and then moves down to the least obligated with municipal debt. And I don't know how much time you guys want to spend on this. I mean, I could run through this real quick if you want, or if you just want to, a couple of pages of the summary of the obligations.
Maybe do the, I think I'm going to have you run through it.
Okay. So the general obligation, we already talked about that. We have $724 million outstanding currently. We have another $110 million authorized but unissued. And we also include interest to maturity on those, although that could change if those bonds are refinanced prior to final maturity. Then there's the state guaranteed debt. This is the HFC Veterans Mortgage Program. They're guaranteed by the state of Alaska, but they actually have a higher credit rating on their own based on the collateralization and repayment of the mortgages that comprise that program. They actually are in the process of issuing up to $75 million additional bonds as we speak. The next level is state-supported debt, and that's where the commitment is authorized by law, but it's subject to annual appropriation. And so the state could choose not to appropriate on these obligations, and the investor wouldn't have direct recourse against the state like they would with general obligation bonds. The state's credit rating would suffer. The state's access to capital markets would suffer, but the investor themselves just wouldn't get paid. And so we have one COP currently outstanding, $24.2 million, and then Goose Creek and the Linney Facility Parking Garage are the other $200 million. The state-supported municipal debt, that's the school debt reimbursement program and the House Bill 528 programs, $769 million. And the school debt reimbursement program. So you can see that's our largest single category of obligation that the state pays on. And that actually is, it's the program that has a current moratorium until next year, until 2020. We already talked about the public employees retirement system and teachers retirement system. Those are the numbers from June 30, 2018, and then the state moral obligation debt is debt where the state bylaw authorizes an entity to issue bonds. They require the entity fund a debt service reserve bylaw, and they require the entity to report the sufficiency of that reserve to the legislature and the governor annually. And it's implied that if the entity had a deficiency in that reserve, that the state would appropriate to replenish it, and that's the moral obligation construct. The largest borrower there is the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank with $1.1 billion of outstanding obligations, and then some AEA and student loan obligations. The student loan obligations, the student loan corporation doesn't issue as many bonds as they once did for programs other than the federal guaranteed programs, and so those balances are likely to become smaller in the future. The revenue bonds, we already mentioned that briefly, Sportfish, and then the airport system. And actually, the Sportfish revenue bonds, I do think those of you that fish, your license, unless there's additional state law passed, cost is going to go down likely in calendar year 2021, because I believe those are going to be paid off in full once we have an optional call provision that we can exercise in April of 2020 that with collections in the summer of 2020 should be sufficient to pay those off.
Is Senator Von Imhoff and Senator Bishop?
So essentially, I'm sort of looking at page 18, the University of Alaska revenue bonds.
Should we wait till we get to that one?
All right.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Sportfish revenue bonds, can you refresh my memory, but are those primarily covering the two hatcheries in Anchorage and Fairbanks?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop. Yeah, they were authorized for those two hatcheries. It turned out it wasn't enough money, and so there was supplementary funding provided for the Anchorage hatchery. And it's supported by a surcharge on license sales, so I think we pay $6 as residents. Non-residents pay a much higher rate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And then just before you jump to the next page on the municipal bond bank, I haven't looked at this year's report. There's a breakdown in it by community of what is owed or like the percentage weighting of the communities that are use the municipal bond bank, is that not correct?
Yes, that's correct. It's both, it's in our audit, that breakdown.
Okay, and I'll get with you later. I'd like to take a look at that, and at some point we need to talk about the debt levels at the municipal level. There's some concerns there also.
Definitely.
So go ahead and continue.
So on the next page, 18, the university obligations. So the university can issue revenue bonds that are supported by tuition, basically revenues that are available to the university. They also have some notes in a small installment contract. Then state agency debt, which the state doesn't have any direct obligation to pay, but it's a political subdivision's obligations. Are with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Again, the bond bank has this Coastal Energy Impact Program, NOAA loan program from years ago, their railroad, and then the tobacco bonds issued through the subsidiary of AHFC. And then state agency collateralized or insured debt, which again aren't, there's no direct obligation to the state, which would be comprised primarily of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation with their home mortgage revenue programs, but also their state capital project bonds, which have been used to fund capital budgets for both the state as well as certain AHFC needs over the years. And then the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority with their revolving fund bond program and power revenue bond program.
Keep going. Are you done with your slide?
Yeah, I just wasn't sure, Mr. Chair, if there was a question from.
I'll stop you.
Okay.
So are you ready for the next slide, Senator Bishop? Sometimes I have to look down at my papers, so I'm not and every once in a while I'll miss someone at the table, but Senator Bishop and then Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mitchell, I think it was my understanding, and if you could correct me, the administration is not going to issue any oil tax credit bonds until the resolution of the current, is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, it is correct.
Okay. Second, if I might, quick follow-ups. If it was if it was good to go, what chart of accounts would that fall under?
State-supported debt, so it would be added to that
okay.
section.
And just final question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did the state issue tobacco settlement bonds prior to the final resolution of a similar litigation?
And when you get when you help the senator with the tobacco bonds, could you is there any issue with that securitization package?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop. The tobacco bonds, there was a master settlement agreement, and it was around 2000, where it wasn't all of the states, but it was a significant number, 40-some states settled with the big tobacco producers, where in that settlement there was a stream of annual transfers to the states. And in Alaska's case, there was, and in many other both cities, counties, and states, there were securitizations of that future revenue stream to provide for projects. And so the state of Alaska essentially sold 40% of that settlement to the Northern Tobacco Securitization Corporation in exchange for a lump sum of money to provide for capital projects. And then a couple of years later, they did another 40%. Both of those were after the MSA was entered into. As far as the creditworthiness of those bonds, there is concern that the settlement revenues are going to be sufficient to avoid a default in future years. I don't know how to handicap that. I'm not, again, an expert on that. Tobacco bonds, I don't regularly follow those since they're an AHFC subsidiary and not involved in the issuance of them or maintenance of them. And if you had more detailed questions, would want to follow up with them.
Right. We'll do that when the time comes. But it is a item that or an issue that we probably need to deal with sometime out in the future. Senator Von Imhoff and then Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you.
Thank you. So through the chair, Mr. Mitchell, two questions, and they kind of blend into one another. One, the first one is do we bond for deferred maintenance? And the reason why I ask that is this report shows the total debt that we have now. What about future asks? Or do you know what the potential is by the university, by the schools, insatiable, right? By the Port of Alaska, bridge capacity of being repaired and so forth. So we have capital. I know we've got a lot of deferred maintenance. How does that all fit into this?
When you answer that question, you might as well throw in the railroad. And can you give the or help the committee with authority that the legislature has allowed to different agencies and groups and what kind of exposure we may or may not have with that?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff. And so the state certainly could bond for deferred maintenance. Those are capital projects that could be funded over time rather than up front. The deferred maintenance backlog of the state isn't incorporated into this analysis. I am sure it's a large number when if there, and I don't know if the Department of Administration or the Department of Transportation has, I would imagine that DOT with public facilities would know what state facilities require deferred maintenance. Otherwise, though, there's a lot of local facilities that the state might have provided for historically that those local entities are hoping for additional funding from the state, and some of that might be deferred maintenance on those projects that were built 10 or 30, 10, 20, 30, 40, whatever years ago. And so that would be something certainly that that is, again, part of that holistic picture that I was talking about earlier. The railroad, they are a quasi-public corporation of the state, and so they have their own metrics for determining debt capacity, which would be based on the revenues of the railroad, or in certain instances, their ability to enter into agreements with the federal government for recurring transfers. So similar to our ability to securitize federal highway funds through a Garvey, and what that means is that you say, well, I'm going to get $100 million each one of the next 10 years, but I've got a $1 billion project I need to build today. And maybe if that's your only project, you would borrow, you would cut the cost to $900 million, and you would borrow the money today and then pay it back over the next 10 years with those federal highway receipts that came in. That's something that's normally not allowed by the federal government to pledge revenue, but it is in the federal highway instance, as well as some other transportation-related, and railroad transportation is one of them. So I know they have some obligations that are outstanding that they rely on federal funding to come through to pay the debt service on them.
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just trying to figure out, in slide 19, you talk about the total general fund principal outstanding, and I'm just trying to correlate that with what I'm seeing on pages 17 and 18, and is that the total state moral obligation debt, $1.897 billion?
I don't think he's presented 19 yet, so maybe we should present that and then try to wrap his question up in it.
Through the chair, yeah, I'll definitely try to do that.
Good.
So that is the next slide. And so this slide is just intended to show the maturity of the obligations that the state has at this point in time. They're not continuing to grow is what I mean by maturity. They're declining. And so the orange is state general obligation principal outstanding from 2000 on a historical basis through the current in 2019, and then prospectively till its final maturity. And then layered on top of that is the lease revenue bonds, certificate of participation, capital leases, and then the school debt reimbursement program. And so at this point, every year that goes by, there's a diminishment in the requirement for funding for the annual debt service if you don't issue any new obligations.
Go ahead and continue. You have a follow-up on that?
Yeah, so just getting back to my question, I'm just trying to correlate this number to the numbers that we see on pages 17 and 18. And if you look at page 17, there's total state moral obligation debt, and that's $1.897 billion. Does that correlate with the total here on page 19?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowson, no, it's not. The moral obligations aren't paid by the general fund. They're backstopped by the general fund, meaning that if there were a credit default, if there were a default at the local level for the bond bank, for example, or with the AEA programs, then the state would be expected to provide a payment if it wanted to, again, maintain its credit rating. But otherwise, those programs have been self-supporting and have never required a transfer from the state. So they're not included on this particular slide.
Follow up.
Can you explain which items are included?
Certainly, through the chair.
And again, correlating that to page 17 and 18, if you
okay,
could.
So on page, so you'd include the state debt on the $724 million, and then you'd include the state supported debt, which would be the 24.2 and the 202.5. And then there's also the municipal debt, so you'd include the school debt reimbursement, 769, and capital project, 26.1. And I think that's it. That's all that are included in there.
Okay, if you could, you can get back to the committee on the table format of those to make it clear to all the members
Sure.
On the clarification of the slide. Do you have a follow-up question?
I do. And then what is, how much more debt can we issue as a state?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we had a discussion about that earlier, and it's uncertain how much additional debt we can issue. I think that I was grappling with the change in unrestricted general fund revenue and how to incorporate that into a debt affordability analysis, and just using the same format from prior use and reducing the metric, it resulted in a $2 billion debt capacity projection, which, like I said, was about a $1.6 or $7 billion increase from last year, and that was based on that increase in unrestricted general fund revenue. And the committee has asked for a revision to that, which is going to provide some lesser amount. I would imagine that it'll be in the, I would just off the top of my head throw $600 million as kind of a debt capacity using the revised metrics the committee has asked for.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
So this slide shows payments from the general fund for the various obligations that were outlined on the prior slide. So just like the outstanding principal is diminishing, these are just the outstanding annual payments that are required, and those are likewise diminishing. And I think the school debt reimbursement program is probably diminishing the most rapidly. I think that's because that program has been outstanding the longest. The state's general obligation program was really initiated in 2003 and reinitiated, I should say. But as time goes by, that's a lot of the means of there being capacity, dovetailing into the last question, is that if you just said, hey, what if we continued to pay at the $200 million a year level for out to 2039, a 20-year type scenario, where you can see that all that back end of the, I don't know what color that is, kind of a light green and gray and orange, that would be how you would pay for that additional capacity, is by maintaining a spending level at where you are today out into the future. Down below, you have debt and statutory payments to PERS, TERS. And again, this slide was incorporated based on the concern about this being the one exception to the decline in annual debt service. And as much as it's actually growing every year, the commitment of the state, and it peaked out in 2039 at $640 million. And so that's a much more difficult budget scenario than a declining obligation. I understand that the ARM board has adopted changes to the actuary assumptions at the meeting last month that are going to modify that projected amortization, and it will increase, and again, this is my understanding, I haven't verified that, I had a brief look at something. My understanding anyway is that it's going to increase the short-term payment requirement but decrease the long-term payment requirement and therefore levelize the annual commitments of the state through the amortization period.
For those at home that missed the earlier presentation several days ago on PERS and TERS, the committee will be asking for runs from our actuary, and we'll be prepared for that discussion on how we want to deal with that issue and if there's some way we can get that obligation down. But clearly in the 15, 16, 17 area of the chart, you see the dip after the $3 billion infusion, which really was, I think, as I recall, about maybe a 2.4 additional infusion. The rest of it was a normal infusion due that year. We had lower fundings, and it just comes back to haunt us. So we're going to have those discussions coming. We just have to have some more analytics run, and we'll have the ARM board in front of us with their with Cowan, their investment consultant. Go ahead and continue.
Okay. And this is just an explanation of short-term borrowing alternatives with bond anticipation notes that can be used to fund authorized debt on a short-term basis in anticipation of a long-term issuance to follow. And then revenue anticipation notes, which are authorized for the state to utilize where there's a revenue deficiency intra-fiscal year. We haven't utilized these, of course, since the 1960s and haven't had a need in any recent time because of the CBR's ability to act as a shock absorber. So intra-fiscal year, the state can borrow from the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund to provide for cash flows that might be required, outflows that might be required before inflows from tax collection or revenue generation might occur.
And that'll be part of the next presenter's presentation when we talk about cash flow.
Okay. The final thing I wanted to talk about is just, I guess I had a fourth part, this is a very short one though, it's just unissued state debt authority. And the reason I throw it in there is because sometimes it seems like And I know this is the case with the pension obligation bonds. There was there were people in the legislature that were surprised that there was an authority for the governor to issue the administration to issue up to $5 billion of pension obligation bonds, and there wasn't any statutory requirement that they come back to the legislature to do so. And that legislation has been changed. It was changed last year. And that authorization was reduced from $5 billion to $1.5 billion, and now there is a requirement in statute for notice to be provided to the legislature prior to issuance of those types of obligations. But there isn't any such requirement for some of the other items that are on the list, and certainly general obligation bonds, maybe that's not as... I think it's just all important to maintain close communication between the legislative branch and the executive branch with potentially adding liabilities that we're actually going to be having to pay on when it's something that might not have been discussed by the legislature for several years. And the one that really pops out, well, GO bonds, those were authorized in 2012 that we'd be selling the $110 million for at some point. We don't anticipate that happening in the near term because we still have about $90 million in a construction fund for that project list. But then the Knick Arm Crossing, that was part of a plan where there was going to be a TIFI loan for $300 million. There was going to be federal highway funds of $300 million or so allocated, and then this $300 million subordinate lien toll revenue bond with a state backstop behind it. Full anticipation of that being paid out of the general fund to provide for the full funding for that project. And there easily could be somebody surprised if we sold $300 million of obligations that were going to come out of the state general fund without additional discussion.
On this, the pension obligation bonds, just for those watching at home, several years ago, 7-8 years ago, whenever it was, when that initial issue was passed, we didn't, unfortunately, put a time frame on it. And I was chairing at the time. In hindsight, 2020, it would have been nice to time it out over 2 or 3 years or some time frame. So there was no timeout window. And that led to some concern a couple, 3 years ago of the amount of funds available to issue without any legislative input. So the legislature took action and lowered that to 1.5. The next item, the $1 billion in tax credits that are roughly due, a little less than that, I think, by the state. We're talking about issuing bonds and paying those off and then paying the bonds off over time. We will be having a discussion here at the table on options on that. Senator Von Imhoff has expressed some interest in seeing if she can't come up with and work with that amortization schedule. I haven't talked to her about this, but she is going to be reengaging on that issue. And we have taken steps to ensure that that happens in the budget process. So we'll have that discussion at the table. And again, this is not to not issue them, but to look at our options on how we structure the issue, not so much for the payment to the industry, but the payment out of the Treasury. So I just don't want to have anybody that's waiting for those credits to be paid at thinking that, you know, there's something else going on. We're looking at how to handle the cash flow side of the state, not blocking the issuance of them. And Senator Wilkowski, did you have a question?
I did. On the tax credit certificate bonds, SC oil tax credit bonds, if we were to issue that bond, would that impact our ability, or how would that impact our ability to issue bonds for other things like infrastructure maintenance?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, it would have some impact. I think as we discussed last year, since this is a liability that we have on the books and we already have a statutory interpreted way of paying them on an annual basis, that it's something we would portray as more of a refinancing than a new money bond issuance. And so we would argue that it would have a diminished impact on capacity than a new money for some other public project might have. And I think when we talked about it last year, might have said like a 25% type, so a handicap, if you will. So if we were to sell the billion, it would be a $250 million type impact. It's also anticipated that it would have a shorter life than most of our debt that we issue. So again, a slightly lesser impact than you might expect if you were going to have a 20 or 25 year amortization.
And we'll have that, I'm sure, a discussion at the table with some other options and see what we want to do. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, on that point, what, and I know you don't classify this as constitutional debt, but what is the impact of to the state of the failure to pay those tax credit bonds once they're issued?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski.
When you answer that question, could you talk about what I think what he's asking is the appropriation risk that the underwriter goes through in analyzing the creditworthiness and risk exposure of the debt instrument, and can you help us with that?
I'll try. So this would be categorized as a subject to appropriation obligation similar to our certificate of participation program or lease revenue bond program. And what that means is that you're committing to seek an appropriation every year, but you're not required by the Constitution or law to provide the appropriation. The legislature has the power of appropriation and can choose every year whether or not they're going to appropriate for something, including an obligation like this. And in the instance of a failure to pay, and it's true on this or a moral obligation commitment or other state-supported commitments, state-supported debt commitments authorized by law, that you would fully expect the state's credit rating to be diminished, and you would expect the state's access to the capital markets to be diminished. That, I mean, I was already hearing, I'm full up on Alaska, I'm out. I mean, I don't like the name. I'm hearing those types of comments when we're selling paper in the capital markets, and so you would just hear that those types of comments that much more.
I think it's unlikely that the underwriters will miss the appropriation risk. The ones that were involved in the issuance of the or the purchase of the or hoping for payments of the tax credit period.
Through the chair, it's a matter that's highlighted multiple times throughout the disclosure document. It's a fundamental tenet of the risk that the investor is taking, maybe not dissimilar to an individual that obtains a signature loan. Well, what happens if you don't pay? I mean, it's not like there's nothing pledged. It's just a signature loan. But your credit rating, your credit quality score is going to diminish, and you're maybe not going to be able to borrow money for a period of time.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, just on that point. We have a statute in place right now that dictates how much is to be paid out, and we've never not paid out what we were supposed to pay under the statute. So if we just keep following the statute, that doesn't risk our credit rating, does it?
Through the chair,
Senator Wilkowski. I have a brief at ease. Thank you. We're back on the record. We had a little glitch, and we didn't want to have the phone beeping when Mr. Mitchell is answering questions. If you could help us, I guess, with that last question.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. I believe that the question was if we continue to pay what we've been paying, will that satisfy our obligation to the purchasers of these securities? And so when these securities are sold, there will be a debt service schedule, a payment commitment made by the state at that point in time that should mirror what, obviously, in conjunction with additional work that this committee might, and others in the legislature might do, should mirror what's authorized. And if then that payment is equal to what otherwise would have been provided under the statutory formula from that forecast. And so as we go through time, the reality, the experience of oil price going up or down and production tax going up or down is going to change what you would have paid in that future year if you hadn't made the commitment. It's either going to be better or worse. If price goes up, then we're going to be paying less than what we otherwise would have been. If price goes down, we're going to pay more than what we otherwise would have been. But we will be, at that point, committed to an annual payment amount that's based on the projections of today. Does that answer your question?
On this issue, it's come up before, and just for clarity, because as the years go by and the numerics move around, we've asked to have that information brought back to the committee, frankly, from the inception of the tax credits, so we can see the statutory required, how much was actually paid. One year there was a veto, and so we can make it very clear at the table where we are today and then how we go forward with this. In this slide here, there's a tax credit certification bond issue shown here as $1 billion. And how that interplays with that, and so we will avoid the discussion on the table of what happened historically. It'll all be right in front of all the members, and we'll try to figure out how we're going to move forward to put that whole issue behind us financially. We have Other questions? I think I've got one other issue. And then I think before I go there, I think what we'll do for the betterment of the committee is take the next presentation, roll it forward till tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to have the issue will be negotiating labor contracts. So before that starts, we will have revenue come forward with a presentation on the savings, the Treasury Division on the savings accounts and budget reserves, which will be the cash position that the state is in, and hopefully we can have a couple of those slides that were questioned today or asked for updates, if any of that work happens to be done, particularly the one on the total savings with the CBR, SBR versus earnings reserve, and tie that all together. I just think it'll flow better, and then we'll flow into the second presentation tomorrow then would be the labor negotiated contract issue, and we'll continue on. I just don't want to rush the cash position issue at the table, because that is frankly the challenge we have, is to meet our obligations in a timely manner and fix the problem in the middle of the table, which is the big deficit issue, one way or the other, before it frankly fixes us. But Mr. Mitchell, just before we let you off the hook today, dealing with municipalities and the debt that they issue through the municipal bond bank, one of the concerns we have is some of us, myself is one of them, is the allowing the municipalities, and they're all different levels of sophistication, from Anchorage on down to totally unsophisticated little communities in this particular arena, where they refinance their debt obligations, stretching out their amortization, even though it meets the net present value calculation of a good, you know, financial move. It rolls forward if that obligation, and then sometimes a municipality will do that more than once, sometimes twice, maybe even more for all I know. But they never pay the debt off. And I'll give you an example how it's the policy of just looking at the net present value is detrimental to a community. Sitka issued some bonds to the municipal bond bank doing a hydro called Green Lake in the early 80s. Time goes on and the public gets grumpy about increasing, in that case, electrical rates. So the municipality then looks at the bonds underlying the asset, and interest rates have gone down since that issuance. So they reissue the bonds, stretching out the amortization. So instead of having, just round off the numbers, you issue the bonds, the 30-year bonds in year 1980, 2010, the hydro should be paid for, and it should be spinning cash flow to beat the band at 3.5 cents a kilowatt or whatever their spin rate is. So they reissue the bonds and stretch out the amortization instead of paying it off in 2010. Now it's 2025 or 30. A few more years go by and they want to build another hydro called Green Lake, or excuse me, Blue Lake. We're color-coded down there. Blue Lake. So they reissue those bonds again on Green Lake for the second time. Now the bloody thing is going to go another 15 years. And all the time, you know, this thing should have been paid off in roughly 30 years, 2010, and my numbers are close on the years. The point I'm trying to make, then they keep stacking these projects forward. They never get them paid off. And they just run into a financial brick wall where they don't have any ability to go out and issue more bonds to build the next hydro or the next, you know, energy producing entity, whatever it is, if it's a gas structure or what have you. So somehow, I think we have failed our supervisory duties in the legislature to ensure that our communities, the sophisticated, and I'd put Sitka in the more sophisticated ones than the less, but the communities across the state don't, are not allowed through the state to continually roll these obligations forward and create a box for the community to walk into some, you know, 40, 50 years later. So if we have a 30-year capital project, it should be paid off in 30 years or 20 years. Get the thing paid off so we can expand the economic base and expand the energy generation for the community is one of the keys. So it's just a point that sticks out in the community I represent. And if it happened to Sitka, and I was probably on the assembly at one time when we authorized that, so I'm not paying Polly purebred here. It's just looking back, we've had some less than optimum policy decisions made. And I'd like, when you have the opportunity to maybe glance at that, those holdings, and have that opportunity to get some feedback back from you and your thoughts on it and how many other communities are exposed to this, because we just might have to play the disciplinarian here. If we're going to build big energy projects, get them paid for so we can build another one. That's the point. So with that, I would thank Mr. Mitchell for coming forward today and help us clarify our debt issuance, as it's always a moving target. Like you say, you've been here in good times and bad times and good decisions and less good decisions are made by all of us. So it is appreciated. And if you can help in the timeliness of getting some of that information back by tonight for the committee, it would be appreciated. I know it's a tight schedule. If you could make it, fine. If you can't, well, the world doesn't end. We go on tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., with the Department of Revenue, the Treasury Division, and we'll talk about the liquidity, the savings accounts, and the budget reserves. And that budget reserve chart was the one I'm referring to. And then we'll follow that up with the regularly scheduled labor contract negotiations. And as we go down the road looking at our cash flow, this is kind of the basis of it the last couple of days, including the first presentation tomorrow. And we'll see everybody tomorrow, 9 a.m. We are adjourned.